Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
So yeah, since last time I've seen you, I've been to West Virginia. First time I've ever been to West Virginia. Now I know why people talk about the hills of West Virginia. I mean, Tennessee is kind of rolling hills and stuff, but boy, you get into that West Virginia area and it's, in fact, I was even kind of picking on them and saying it's hard for me to believe that human beings got to here and said, yeah, let's just settle here, because that's just rough terrain. And on the drive up there on Thursday, we ran into a storm that then hail joined the storm. So we were getting pummeled with hail. So we pulled off onto a rest stop and waited over there. My car actually has some pockmarks from the hail hitting us. And then Paul Pendleton called me and said, are you coming up to 77 yet? And I said, yeah, we just went through the first tunnel and we're about to hit the second tunnel. And he said, well, there's been a bad accident there too, so you might run into some traffic. And so now we're driving through the storm post-hail and all the flashing highway signs are saying, watch out for road debris. And I turned to my daughter and said, if we hit a plague of frogs, I'm turning around. This is getting rough. But we got there safely on Thursday, and they put us up in a very nice hotel, the folks of Sovereign Grace Chapel in Crow, West Virginia. Couldn't have been any kinder to us. Really, really treated us well. Folks have already asked, I do have audio from Friday night and Sunday morning. There was a technical glitch with the Saturday evening service, so there's no, even though there's video with no audio. So that's, you can watch me pantomime the gospel, but that's about the most you can hope for. But I started working on the audio stuff today, and so that'll go up on our website in the next couple of days as well. Since getting home, I got to hear Tom's very good message from Sunday, and that's already up on our website, so folks can go and listen to that. We had some great visitors in West Virginia. Marlon Tillman and his family took the four-hour drive and came down on Saturday and stayed till Sunday. So it was great to see them. Elder Tom Newman came in. And the Kimberlin family, some of you would remember the Kimberlins. We haven't seen them in 5 years. But I had the great pleasure of baptizing Chris and one of their daughters 5 years ago over homecoming. And Chris painted a painting for us all those years ago that's still up in the front office. And he brought me a drawing this year, a pencil drawing he had done of Elder Ward. And when he handed it to me, Marlon Tillman came from across the yard because he saw it and said, is that Elder? Came over and plucked it out of my hands and was admiring it. And I had to wrestle him to the ground. And so there was a little bit of wrestling between elders in suits out in the... But so I did bring that home. It was very, very nice of Chris to do that. And then I met several people who came up and said, I listen to you all the time on the internet. Oh, we came to see you. People who drove in from the area and some who were part of the church there. So again, even though it was a small church tucked away in Crow, West Virginia, yet again, listeners, we had a listener who came in from Kentucky who came in for the whole weekend. So just great to see that kind of response. They knew us so well that when the pastor, Walter Pendleton, was introducing me, he said, you all know Jim well enough by now that you know his introductions can get a little long. So they already knew my punchlines before I got to them. And once he said that, I knew that we were among friends and it was all going to be just fine. So as soon as I threw out my first sarcastic comment and they responded positively, I felt like I was home. So that worked out really, really well. So thanks to the folks in West Virginia. And then coming home on Monday, since we didn't get to stop and do anything touristy on the way up, I promised Megan, since she was my partner and co-pilot and took care of me the whole time, I promised her we would do something fun on the way back. And as we were coming back, she kept looking at the pictures that said sharks all the way down the 40 freeway. Sharks! And we said, let's go see sharks. So we pulled off at Sevierville and went up to Gatlinburg and went to the aquarium and went and saw sharks. And then we were leaving there, and you may recall that last year Tom and I went up to Gatlinburg for a couple of days and met up with the musicians that we used to play with out in California. Well, the piano player still lives up there in Sevierville and plays in one of the shows up there. And so I gave him a phone call and said, "Hey, I'm in town. Do you have time for dinner? We're on our way out of town, but we got to stop and eat." He said, "I can't. I've got the show tonight. Why don't you come to the show?" And I said to Megan, "We're going to get home really late." And so we went and saw the Country Tonight show, which was Mom and Apple Pie, Americana, Gospel, Country, Johnny Cash, Elvis, Stand Up and Salute. It was really, really well done. I mean, very professional, good musicians, good singers and dancers. And then we got to hang out with Ron, the piano player, afterwards. And it was just really fun. But we didn't get out of there till 10:15. After walking through all the aquarium for a few hours, then dinner, and then the show. So 10:15, we've still got 3.5 hours to 4 hours to getting home. Fortunately, we gained an hour on the way, but that didn't make us any less tired. So we came careening into our driveway about 1:15 and brought our luggage in, dropped it on the floor, and went, "There, we're home." And so yesterday was sort of a recovery day, but I have to admit that I'm still tired today because I just don't sleep well in hotels to start with. And then the big hurrah for our last day on the road, and I sure did enjoy it. So no complaints, and again, thanks to the folks in West Virginia. Turn to 1 Samuel 13. Last time we saw the children of Israel, Samuel had, at the end of chapter 12, prayed for the people of Israel, prayed for their king, and had told them, don't turn aside from the things that God had given them to do. Don't go after things that do not profit or deliver because they are futile. Verse 22 of chapter 12 said, "For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you will still do wickedly, both you and your king shall be swept away." Starting in chapter 13 and for the next couple of chapters, we're going to see Saul the king immediately make two enormous mistakes. And as a result, Samuel says to him, God would have established your household. After all, God had picked Saul. And he says, but because of how you're disobeying, your household is not going to continue, and God has already chosen a man after his own heart. And this is the first time that we're going to see David referred to as a man after God's own heart. And we'll talk about that more as we progress into it. But it leads to the question, what does that mean? When you use the phrase man after God's own heart and you're speaking of David, it's easy for us to romanticize that notion and say, well, what that means is that David was gracious like God, so he had God's own heart, or that he was loving to Israel the way God was, so he was a man after God's own heart. But contextually, what you're going to see is what it means is a man who will be obedient to what God says. In other words, whatever is in God's heart is what this man also wants. That's what it is to be a man after God's own heart. Turn forward to chapter 15 for just a moment, because this is really the summation of these couple of chapters of Saul's disobedience and mistakes. And the summation is important to remember. So we're going to look at the summation first and then back up and read through the story. It'll probably take us 2 weeks to get through the whole of these two big mistakes. But look at chapter 15, starting at verse 22. Samuel said, "Does the Lord have as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" Because Samuel's second big mistake is going to be to not destroy the animals that God said should be destroyed, the animals that belong to the Amalekites. And when he does not destroy them, his excuse is, well, we kept them to sacrifice for God. Even though God had said destroy them, his excuse is going to be, well, I decided that it would just be better. We're just going to do something better. We're going to keep these because they're good, and we're going to sacrifice them. Now, I kind of think, and you can kind of see it in the verbiage, that perhaps Saul was caught out and came up with this excuse, because he also then ends up saying, look, I did everything God said, but those people, they're the ones who kept the animals. And, oh yeah, the animals are going to be used for sacrifice. But there's no indication when they're originally kept that they were for God's glory. It looks like they were just kept because this was part of the plunder of the Amalekites. So their excuse becomes, well, it was for God. We did this for God. And so the answer from Samuel is, does God have as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as he has in obeying his voice? In other words, God would rather you obey than keep these trappings of religion that they thought were going to satisfy God, that if they just brought these animals and sacrificed them to God, that was going to cover up for their rebellion and their sin. And Samuel refocuses and says, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. And that's a theme that even David, the man after God's own heart, is going to pick up in the Psalms and carry on that idea that the true sacrifice of God is a broken and a contrite heart. The sacrifice of animals is not what God is looking for. He's looking for the sacrifice of a life of obedience to him. Paul even picks it up in the book of Romans when he says to bring your body a living sacrifice to God, which he then says in the King James, is your reasonable service, so that we would obey his voice, obey him as his people, and that that's God's ultimate desire and requirement for his people, not the religious practices that people become so enamored with. They think if they just do the stuff, whatever the prescribed stuff is, if I just do the stuff, it doesn't matter how I live the rest of the time. Verse 23 then picks up, well, the end of verse 22 says, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed, or to listen and to do, is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination. In other words, rebellion is just like witchcraft. And insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. So he's really raised this up and put it on a level of disobedience, rebellion, and says it's like witchcraft, it's like idolatry, it's among the worst of the sins that the law ever lists. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. And so Saul is going to lose the kingship, and his family is not going to inherit the throne because of his repeated rebellion. So what we're going to be looking at is the rebellion and the attitude with which he does the rebellious acts. We've talked before about these incursions against God's rules and God's laws, and that it is presumption against God. Once God says, this is how it is, to assume that he doesn't mean that, or that you can improve on it, or that you can do it your own way, or that God's going to leave it up to your opinion, is a presumption against God that is the very essence of rebellion. Now, since God doesn't change, let's bring that into the New Testament and the New Covenant for a moment, because God said when Jesus was baptized, this is my son, hear him. And then on the Mount of Transfiguration, repeated it a second time after Moses and Elijah appeared and then were gone. The voice said, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased, hear ye him. Now that's a directive, that's a command. Hear him. Whatever he says, hear him. And if you belong to him, or name his name, or claim to be a disciple, then you hear him and you follow him, which means you have to pay attention to what his word actually says and be obedient to it. It doesn't matter what your opinion is. It doesn't matter what your personal improvements might be to the gospel message. It doesn't matter if you think, well, this message is going to put people off. I think I could make it a little more approachable, a little more user-friendly. I think I could make it more palatable to people and probably get more people in if I don't say it the way the Bible says it. Perhaps I could say it a little more kindly. Perhaps I could say it with a little less emphasis on God's complete sovereignty. Perhaps I could just avoid that election stuff because that's just divisive and that divides people. You know, that doctrine divides and experience unites kind of thinking. So I'll just avoid doing and saying things the way the Word says to do them. I'll just create a better, friendlier version of it, and I'll bring that to God, and He'll understand because my intentions were good. You know, I kept the animals alive because, after all, I was going to sacrifice them to Him. So He'll understand. Problem is, God doesn't understand that. He didn't understand it when the sons of Aaron brought strange fire in. Well, He's not going to understand it when Saul decides to do what only a high priest can do. He doesn't understand it when he says, kill all the animals, and Saul doesn't kill them and uses the excuse of, well, I kept them for you. He loses the kingship for that, and it is a continual punishment. Nobody in his family or lineage then gets to be king, even though Samuel will take the time to say, God would have established you, but you needed to be obedient. So he has already found a man, which is really interesting. Even as the disobedience is occurring, Samuel says, and he has already chosen a man, who at the time is a young boy, David. There's predestinary sovereignty right there. He's already chosen a man after his own heart who will be obedient to him. So this is the essence of Saul's problem, but it is also the essence of the human problem and far too much of the problem within Christian circles and quote-unquote evangelical churches is that they really do refuse to listen to what God says and to what God prescribes, to what God's Word teaches, to how God will be approached. And instead they think that they can just improve on it in order to accomplish a more human end, which is to bring more people in to make it more approachable, as I've said. But if God, in fact, doesn't change, then what we're about to read is certainly a warning to everybody who names the name of Christ and to anybody who claims to be a child of God that our command, our directive, is to do things God's way and let Him decide what the outcome is. We don't decide about the outcome. If He said, kill all the animals, you kill all the animals. If He said, you don't get to be high priest, then you don't get to be high priest. And if He says, this is my son, hear Him, then we need to hear Him in everything that He has said and everything that is written about Him, and we don't get the option to decide which parts we like and which parts we don't. Yes. It's up to God. Our job is to obey and not presume. Yes?
Amen.
All right. I'm all stirred up, see?
Sounds good.
Yeah. Turns out when I get to talk a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday, I get all revved up. And then I fall asleep.
So sad.
We are in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. Saul's reign starts right around the 1000 BC period of time. Now, that's a very round number. It's slightly before that, seems to end somewhere around 1007. He has a 32-year reign over Israel. Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. The reason that I bring up the time period is that about 400 years have passed since the Exodus. The most common number that you see listed for the Exodus is right around 1446 BC. And so by the time Saul begins his reign, it's been about 440 years, more or less, give or take. And yet God is going to tell Saul to go attack the Amalekites because of how they mistreated Israel when Israel came out of Egypt. Which means God is going to use Saul to exact vengeance 400 years after the fact. This is a God with a long memory. And human beings think that just because God doesn't immediately respond, that they got away with it. And of course, the Amalekites, who are going to pay the price, weren't even alive when this happened. And so God gives these people time and then punishes them hundreds of years later. Now, this is applicable to the time and place in which we live, because our nation has been a nation since 1776, so 200 and change there. 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. I remember that from my school days. And so we've been a nation separate from the English crown for 200 and some odd years. We've been a separate people established by Europeans for 500. But the first settlers who came here were religious people, the Pilgrims and the Puritans who arrived on our shore. And we've talked oftentimes about not only the Christian but the Calvinistic influence on the early settlers. Fast forward to 2012, and our nation is in a state of religious apostasy unlike anything we've known in our history. Throughout the Bible, the first sign that a people are under God's punishment is that he withholds himself from them, and they slip further and further away from him and further into sin, rebellion, debauchery, that he ultimately will punish. There was a phrase floating around several years ago that said, if God doesn't judge America soon, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. And there's a basic truism behind that. But Sodom and Gomorrah didn't start there. God punished them at the appropriate time. The Amalekites didn't start there. God gave them appropriate amounts of time. America didn't start there. God's given us an appropriate amount of time. We have now, over the course of time, because we've been fat and happy, and because we've been protected, and because we've had the best of everything, we have forgotten the God who established us here and who has protected us and fed us all this time. And now we are demonstrating the same sort of rebellious spirit and attitude that is what you find among the Amalekites and the Philistines and other nations that God allowed to just flail away in their own rebellious ego. And he just removes his hand further and further. And of course, it happened with Israel over and over, where every time they needed God, they would cry out, like September 11th, when America cried out to God, and only took us a decade to go, well, never mind, we've got this covered. Until we're at a state now where our options in the upcoming presidential election, and I'm certainly not going to do politics here tonight, but our choices now are a really questionable sitting president. And by questionable, I mean he certainly is not an advocate for evangelical Christianity. He carries a Bible occasionally and shows up in church, but during his administration, there's been an awful lot of anti-Christian legislation that has occurred during his watch. And our other choice is a Mormon. And so we're at a really strange crossroads at this moment. And so I say all that to say, yeah, that's kind of how God's always been. And the only thing we've learned from history is that we've learned nothing from history. And we need to keep shouting from the rooftops, wake up, America. But once God removes his hands, there's no going back. And unless God purposefully opens eyes and ears and hearts, I don't know, we're kind of at that tipping point, and it worries me. So I said all that to say, chapter 13, verse 1 starts like this, and we'll get to the Amalekites by the time we get to chapter 15. But that was all in my head. I just had to get it all out. Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. Now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. Now, we're going to hear a lot about this town called Michmash, which is the word that has migrated into the English word as mishmash, because it means confusion, the same thing that a mishmash is. Actually, there still is a town. There is an Arab village known as Mukmas that preserves the name of the biblical city of Michmash. And the town sat next to a place that is called the Pass, which is mentioned twice in this passage we're going to read through. This pass is a very important north-south route. And this Michmash lays kind of at the border between the northern and the southern kingdom. So it's a real important centralized city that a lot of trade moves through. And if you're going to move from the north to the south, it's important to go through that area and through this pass. And this pass is going to become important, so we'll talk about it more as we continue. But he sent away the rest of the people. Each of them went to their tent. Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. And the people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore for abundance. And they came up and they camped at Michmash, east of Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in thickets and in cliffs, in cellars and in pits. When the people of Israel saw that they were surrounded by this massive army that was now encamped in this very important city, Michmash, which is between the northern and the southern kingdoms, over which they can control this very important pathway. The hill country in that area is deeply cut with deep canyons, which are called wadis, that run east and west. And if you were to look at it on a topographical map, you can see all of these deep canyons that run east to west. And so they restrict any traffic to the ridges that are above the wadis, making passage north-south really difficult, except on the central watershed ridge. One exception to this is the pass of the Wadi Suwanit, which is a broad place in the canyon where passage north-south is easy. And consequently, this route is noted in Scripture on several occasions. Isaiah the prophet speaks about an invasion from the north-south that moves by Michmash across the pass and on to Geba and Ramah and Gibeah and Jerusalem. And so on either side of this pass are these very high, very rocky, steep cliffs. People traveling east-west were able to travel through some of the canyons, or they would travel up above the canyons. But north-south, this pass was the typical easiest trade route. And now you've got the Philistines controlling that, camping in it. So they're really effectively able to cut off travel, communication between north and south, and they're planted right there in Israelite territory. As a consequence, being in that kind of strait, the Hebrews run for cover, just to save their own lives, because they're overwhelmed. So verse 7 tells us, some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. And he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Look back at 1 Samuel 10:8 for a second. Just go backwards to chapter 10, verse 8. This is where Samuel gives Saul this instruction and says, "You will go down before me to Gilgal." This is when he said, "These are the things that are going to happen to you. And once those things have happened, you'll know that God has chosen you to be king. And you'll go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You will wait 7 days until I come to you, and then I will show you what you should do. So there's a clear instruction from Samuel, from the prophet of the Lord. Go there, wait 7 days, I will come, and then we'll sacrifice to God. We are back in chapter 13, verse 8. He waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings," and he offered the burnt offering. Verse 10, and it came about, this is just providential timing, and it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him, like, "Hi, everything's great. It's good that you're here." But Samuel said, "What have you done?" Samuel knows, he's the prophet, you're not going to hide anything from him. And Saul said, here come the excuses. And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said," there's the problem right there, "you told me what to do, you gave me the command from the Lord, it's not my place to offer burnt offerings, especially not on behalf of the people. I am not the priest. I'm the king, but there are three primary offices in the Old Testament. We've talked about this. There's prophet, priest, and king. And even though there are men who have had two of those offices at any one time, nobody gets to do all three. And so far, Saul has prophesied, and so there's the adage, is Saul among the sons of the prophets? And he's king. He doesn't get to do what the high priest does. The only person in the Bible ever spoken of as prophet, priest, and king is Christ. And nobody gets to mess with that typology. But notice the excuse was, "I saw that you didn't come within the appointed days," and so now he's justifying his actions based on, "Well, you did, and the people were leaving, and this was happening, so it just seemed rational to me to make a decision to do something, even though I knew what you said. I'll just do things my way because I think I can improve on this." And clearly this is what God would have wanted under these circumstances. "So I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord.' So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Yeah. I really twisted my own arm. "I didn't want to have to do this, but you didn't show up on time, and the people were scattering. I needed to hear from God, even though I'm not allowed to do that. Even though you're the one who's supposed to do it, you weren't here. So I just presumed on you and on God and decided to force myself to do something I have absolutely no business doing." Shall we apply this? Because I'm willing to go so far as to say that human beings simply have no warrant or leave or invitation to change or conform or mold or modify the Word of God in any aspect. The Bible says what it says. And if you're not willing to preach what it says, no matter how many times or how many ways you justify it by saying, "Well, this is what was good for the people. God, the way you say it, that's just too rough. That's too difficult, too hard. So therefore, I have forced myself for the good of the people to change things a bit, to modify it a bit, because that's what seemed right to me." You have no warrant whatsoever to do anything beyond what God says. And what the ministers of God are told to do is preach the word, sound doctrine. Preach, teach, teach, preach. Concentrate on the word. Deacons were added to the church so that elders would be able to devote themselves to prayer and study of the word. It couldn't be more clear. It couldn't be more precise. And after all the time we've spent in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus here, we've certainly heard an awful lot about sound doctrine, sound doctrine, sound doctrine. That's what we're told to do. And yet the people who will not do that always have a justification for it, always have a rationale for it. And the rationale is always, well, I just thought this was what was better for the people. You know, you're going to get more people in if I do it this way. We can build a bigger church to your glory, God, if we just do it this way. This is going to spread your message further, and more people are going to hear it, and we're going to have a greater influence on the community if we just do it this way, God. But God couldn't be more precise about how he wants his church to function and what it is we are to preach. And so there's the modern application of a continual problem that is going on to this very day, is that God couldn't be any more clear and precise in saying, this is my word, this is my expectation, this is what you do, this is how you approach me, this is what you teach, this is who you listen to, and yet churches abandon that constantly in favor of, well, I'll just have to force myself to do it my way, and I'll justify it later. And God will be okay. God will understand. It'll be okay. God will understand. Except there's not a place in the Bible where you find, well, God will understand. You just go ahead and presume. We are now in verse 13. And Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Notice that. That God has already chosen who we know to be David, and Samuel just showed up there. And yet God was so sure that Saul was going to do it that Samuel's able to walk right up and say, the kingdom's taken away from you. God has already chosen a man after his own heart, someone who will obey him, someone who will be obedient, and he is going to rule, and your family is not going to rule. So God knew going in when he chose Saul what kind of person he was choosing, what kind of person he was putting in rulership and kingship, and that it was not going to be his family lineage that was going to continue, that he already had David in place. Isn't that interesting? Verse 15. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Then Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying in Geba of Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Michmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah and the land of Shual. The other company turned toward Beth Horon. And another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Starting in verse 19, this is a parenthetical bit of historic information that Samuel throws in. Now, no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. So this was a way that the Philistines managed to keep Israel from being able to fight back, was that they didn't apparently pass on the blacksmithing trade or wouldn't allow, if there was a blacksmith, wouldn't allow him to stay in business. So the Israelites were dependent on the Philistines in order to have their instruments sharpened, their plows or their spears. So they didn't have any swords or spears as a result. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for a plowshare, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they, Saul and Jonathan, did have some. They were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. So now they're controlling the pass. They're controlling that city. They're controlling the travel. The Israelites are hiding in their caves and their dens and their thickets. So the Canaanites, the Philistines, are in control. Now the day came, chapter 14, verse 1, that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the yonder side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was staying out in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitab, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. And between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp crag on one side and a sharp crag on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Senah. And the crag rose to the north opposite Michmash, and the other on the south opposite Geba. So what you're really seeing here is, because they're controlling the pass, Jonathan goes the overland route. And in order to get to the other side, he's going to have to go down one side, across the pass, and up the other side. And that's why these steep crags matter. He's got a lot of climbing to do here, a lot of mountaineering to get across to them. Verse 6, then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." And his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart, turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire." And Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross to the men and reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand in our place and we will not go up to them." That means once they get down to the pass and they get across, they're going to start climbing up the other side. If the men seeing them climbing up say, "Don't come up," he says, "We're going to stay there and we're not going to go up," because that means God's not going to give them into our hands. But, verse 10, "But if they say, 'Come up to us,'" that means continue your climb, "then we will go up. For the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us." Now that's really, really interesting. That's very much like the golden fleece. And by the way, it's also very much like the Gideon idea that God is going to save by the 300. I think that may have been the influence for Jonathan to say that it's not a big deal for God to save by many or by few. He certainly knows that this is the history of the God of Israel. And so he throws this out there and says, if we hear them say this, if they say, "Come up," then we're going to know, we're going to beat them, and we're going to go. And his armor bearer goes with him. There's a faithful servant. As opposed to, "Really, you and me?" "Whatever you say." And when both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, "Behold, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." So they're mocking them. Look, they're coming out of their caves and their holes. Verse 12, "So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, 'Come up to us and we will tell you something.' And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, 'Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel.'" They think, "Come on up, we got something to tell you." It was just their way of saying, "Come on up here," so they could either kill them or utilize them in any way they wanted. And instead, it turns out that God is going to turn the tables on them. So verse 13, "Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet," because of course he's climbing this steep crag using his hands and feet, "and his armor bearer behind him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer put some to death after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half a furrow in an acre of land." Short area, 20 people. Jonathan wipes them out with his armor bearer. And there was a trembling in the camp and in the field and among all the people. This trembling doesn't seem to be directly associated with the killing. This is God beginning to put a fear into the Philistines, because watch what happens. "Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. So not only does God put fear in them, but then he shakes the earth on top of that so that they're really beginning to get confused and troubled and trembling. Verse 16, now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. And they went here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, number now and see who has gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Then Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. That's a mistake, by the way. We remember earlier that Israel made a similar mistake. Fortunately, providence intervenes here, for the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. And it happened while Saul talked to the priest. Isn't that good timing? It happened. I think this is just God providentially stopping Saul from making a huge error. It happened while Saul talked to the priest that the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, never mind. Withdraw your hand. Don't bring the ark. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow. And there was very great confusion. So the Israelites aren't really even having to fight at this point. The Philistines are killing each other in the midst of their confusion. And the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. And when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-haven. Now this battle is going to go on for a while. In verse 24 we read, now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under an oath. Starting in verse 24, we're going to hear about this oath that Saul imposed on his soldiers, another one of Saul's mistakes. This is one of those places where he decides, apparently without checking with God or anything, that he's going to place an oath on these people as if they belong to him, and he's going to bind them to this oath of hunger, and he's going to have to pay for it. Saying, cursed be the man who eats food before evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. So the people are all going to go hungry until he as king has avenged himself. And all the people of the land entered the forest and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore, he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened, which means he was revived. Got some sugar into his system, got a little bit of nutrition going. Then one of the people answered and said, your father strictly put people under an oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. And the people were weary. They were tired. They wanted to eat. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. In other words, there's a lot of fighting still to do. And as we killed these people and they had food, you all should have been able to eat it. But my father's made a mistake. Jonathan recognizes that he has troubled the land. And the people, verse 32, when they heard this, the people rushed greedily upon the spoil, and they took sheep and oxen and calves, and they slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. More mistakes. Now the implication is, if Saul had simply just let them eat and refresh themselves in the battle, they wouldn't have been this famished. And now they're so hungry, they're eating food with the blood in it. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. He's going to build an altar. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into the hand of Israel?" But God did not answer him that day. So Saul said, "Draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sign has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not one of the people answered him. And then he said to all Israel. Now, what's happening here is he realizes that God didn't answer, so that there must be some kind of sin in the camp. This is kind of one of those Achan deals. There's an Achan in the camp somewhere. So we need to figure out who it is so that we can deal with him, and then maybe God will answer. So he says, "You see this sign? God's not answering, and even if it's Jonathan, my son, he will surely die. So draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." But not one of the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." I think he did that because he assumed it won't be our side. It's going to be somebody over there. And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot," or make a perfect choice. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, "Cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son," and Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him and said, "I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die." Jonathan stands up to his father's decree, to his father's command, says, "I must die." And Saul said, "May God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to their own place. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab and the sons of Ammon, Edom, and the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment, and he acted valiantly, and defeated the Amalekites, and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, and Ishvi, and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. I've heard some people call her Michael. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. We'll start next week in verse 15, because now Saul has got a couple of mistakes in place. Now he's going to make the worst of them, which is not following a direct command to destroy the Amalekites and the animals. And then the kingdom will be taken from him. He'll remain king for a while with the knowledge that his family is not going to continue in the kingship. And he's going to rebel against that. And once he's around David, you know, there are going to be times when an evil spirit takes him. He's even going to throw a javelin at David. He recognizes that his family's being replaced and that it's David's family that's going to be taking over. And so the balance of 1 and 2 Samuel, well, at least the balance of this part of 1 Samuel is going to be about this ongoing conflict, Saul against all the nations, and Saul against David, and Saul against his family, and then Jonathan's going to go in league with David against his own father. And so Saul is really going to pay a terrible price all the way along, including his own ultimate suicide, because he just wouldn't do things God's way. And God simply is not going to give him peace from his enemies, or peace in his family, or peace in his own heart and mind, because he simply won't do things God's way. So if there's a lesson to be had here tonight, it's if God has spoken, then that's that. And our directive as the people of God is to align ourselves with what God has said, not be presumptive, not take it upon ourselves to decide that God either didn't mean it or that we can improve on it. And whatever God has said, it is our job to obey it. And God wants that more than sacrifice. He wants that more than the trappings of religious ceremony. It's not enough to just, you know, live like hell all week and then show up for church for an hour. That's not going to do it. The trappings of religion aren't enough. It's obeying God and living in such a way that His word, His command, His directive is primary in our lives and in our decisions and our choices and our families and our households and ultimately in our church. So that's the lesson for this evening. Are there any questions? No? We're good?
That's good.
Good.
The military commands were taken very
seriously.
Seriously. Yep. No man dare break a military command, even in that chapter.
Yeah.
Whatever was military, the Saul gave as a command, they saw to it that it was falling
absolutely
down, and they feared not to obey that command.
Right. And remember, he's
can take the command of God and just.
Right. You make a very good point. And in fact, I'm going to repeat your point for the folks on the internet. I'll probably extrapolate it and say it with more words than you just did, but it's a really good point, which is, first off, since it was a military command and Saul was the king of the military and was the king that God put in place over Israel and had been anointed by Samuel and is going to be anointed before the people as the king of Israel, they assume that whatever Saul says, that's God's command. And so to sin against the king was equal to sinning against God himself. So they took the command really, really seriously because they assumed it was a command from God.
And just like in our society today, the only commands that are really obeyed are in the military.
Right, exactly. But then Gladys made the point that, and yet, despite that example where the people would even starve themselves because they believed that was a command from the king, which was a command from God, these days people can see commands from God and just treat it completely haphazardly, have no interest or respect for it at all, especially if it requires the least little amount of sacrifice. People aren't willing to do it. They think that it's really up to them, their choice, their opinion, to decide whether or not to keep God's commands. And boy, if there's, again, a moral or a lesson to be had from this, it's that God does not change, and His commands are His commands. Your job is obedience. Every time, your job is obedience. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.